Hey, Jenna here from the show Pacific Underground, the radio show that explores the Asian and Pacific Islander experience in America. We're looking for producers and writers to join our team. So we're inviting those who identify as Asian or Pacific Islander to attend a Pacific Underground information meeting on Wednesday, April 26th at 7 p.m. at KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue at Burnside. More information can be found at www.pacificunderground.org or on our Facebook at PAC Underground.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of La Inaugurada La Primavera on April 21st and 22nd. Two nights of joy and justice in a multi-venue call to action in response to the immigration ban. On April 21st, La Inaugurada La Primavera features Alex and Allison Gray, Las Cafeteras, and Gran Ritmos, Ed Navasquez, and Voz Workers' Rights Education Project at the Melody Ballroom. April 22nd at the Crystal Ballroom will feature Alex and Allison Gray, Daca Braca, Future Primitive, The Human Experience, and Orquesta Pacifico Tropical. Again, that's La Inaugurada La Primavera on April 21st and 22nd, two nights of joy and justice in a multi-venue call to action in response to the immigration ban. Venue addresses and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. And coming right up, we've got Veterans Voice this morning. Today, former Army Airborne Ranger Dave Edgar reflects on his military experiences in Central America in the 1980s. And then at 10 o'clock, we've got Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on the Radio Zine, a live interview with ex-CIA operative John Kiriakou, who was sent to federal prison for blowing the cover off of the torture scandal at Guantanamo Bay. At 11:30, Making Contact presents Spies of Mississippi, the true story of a secret spy agency formed by the state of Mississippi to preserve segregation and maintain white supremacy. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're just a listener and not a current member, you can become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says donate. And now let's get going with Veterans Voice.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming, 'cause the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Mothers and fathers throughout the land.
Welcome to Veteran Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 Hood River, and 104.3 FM Corvallis, and Albany. And you can hear KBOO on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. And if you feel like listening to some of our earlier shows, you can go to kboo.fm/Veterans Voice. And Angie's been putting stuff on Facebook, so if you want to see some great articles that Angie's put on Facebook, you just go to Veterans Voice Radio Show on Facebook, and it'll bring stuff up. I'm Marvin, and with Angie.
Hello, Angie.
Angie here. And we got a great show today, and we're going to start it in just and Angie will introduce the guest, and we'll start in just a minute. But I want to start by, you know, we lost a great peace veteran not too long ago. Charlie Litke died. And Charlie was a great guy. He was a chaplain, Catholic chaplain in Vietnam. And he had no combat experience at all. He went out with a unit. They got attacked. And Charlie got up and ran out and drug 23 guys back, saved 23 men. And he got wounded once in the neck and once in the leg. And I think his foot, he got shot in his foot. And he drug 23 guys out of the battlefield. And he's a chaplain. And one of the guys was so big that Charlie had to lay on his back and put the guy on his chest and used his heels and his elbows to get the guy out. And Charlie was, he got the Congressional Medal of Honor. That's the highest one for a military for bravery is the Congressional Medal of Honor. And after he got out of Vietnam, he quit the military and he quit the priesthood and he married a next nun. And he, along with some other guys, he did a fast on the steps of the Congress against what was going on down in Nicaragua and El Salvador, along with our good friend Brian Wilson. Brian was part of that. And the thing about Charlie, he was so angry about what was happening down in Nicaragua and El Salvador and different places. He gave back his Medal of Honor. He's the only man who ever gave back the Medal of Honor, the only guy. And he was a great, great guy. And, you know, the world lost a great peace activist when Charlie died. And so I just wanted to let everybody know. And Angie can introduce our guests.
Yes, we are going to speak with Dave Agurk today. Dave, would you like to say hello to everybody very quickly?
Hello, everybody. Good morning.
He's going to speak with us very shortly. I just wanted to let everybody know that there is a film, if you're available on Sunday night, there's a film called 30 Seconds to Midnight, and that is going to be at the Clinton Street Theater this Sunday at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. The director is Regis Tremblay, and the film addresses the threat to life on the planet, nuclear technology, nuclear war, and climate change. And this is sponsored by Veterans for Peace Chapter 72. That's this Sunday, 7 p.m., and the director is going to be present answer questions and introduce his film. And I was put on a email loop somehow, and I came across these really awesome pictures of a van that was made mobile to help houseless veterans in the Olympia area, and I contacted the people that were part of this email loop, and so I asked them to come on the show for the first 10 minutes or so to talk about what they're doing with the mobile outreach van. And I do believe that we have Dennis and Mark with us right now. Are you hearing me?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, great.
I'm here.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Here.
How are you?
Doing fine. Good.
We're
to see
doing fine here in Olympia.
Great. I just wanted to ask you if you could please talk for a few minutes about the
mobile outreach van, and maybe introduce yourself and talk about the van and how it got started and what it's about?
Would you like me to start, Mark?
Yes, you want to start?
Oh, okay.
Okay, you start.
Mark? Yeah, Mark and I are independent, accredited Veterans Affairs claims agents. And wow, we do this as part of our Veterans for Peace Chapter 109 outreach program. And we've been volunteering through a group called Sidewalk on Thursdays, which works with veterans to end homelessness, because Mark and I can help them get their earned VA claims. And one of the people volunteering there was a retired colonel, battalion commander at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And he was so intrigued with the fact that we were helping veterans get finances so that they could get homes to live in, that he says, well, I have a 28-foot motorhome. I'll donate it to you guys for this project. And thus began the project of outfitting a used 28-foot Four Winds motorhome.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So actually, this is part of something we've been doing for some time. We'd worked with Iraq Veterans Against the War at the Coffee Straw and Coffee House outside JBLM. And since that closed, this gave us another opportunity to kind of outreach. You know, we do this somewhat in the spirit of Veterans for Peace, healing the wounds of war. And we also do it to help remind people that there are additional costs to war after the guns fall silent. So this is our way of expanding that.
You know, and part of the Veterans for Peace statement is to increase the public awareness of the causes and costs of war. And that's what Mark and I do. We don't have to advertise that or shout that message out. Our physical presence of helping veterans, we're both veterans from the days of Vietnam, so we have, you know, the skills to help veterans get those benefits, but having this now mobile home with the signage on it and the Veterans for Peace logo on it and saying end veteran homelessness, and get your earned VA benefits, it's making a statement to the public as well as to those veterans.
And also, too, just the fact that this retired colonel, who when he was a commander told his people to stay away from Coffee Strong, was willing to work with us, tells us we're making an impact.
Yeah, great.
What exactly do you have in the van for people?
Right now we will have, we're still out refurbishing it, but we will have, you know, a place to meet with them. Basically, place to meet, get some information. We'll come back and do whatever filing we need back at home where we have wireless and phone connections. Mainly the van is just to make a presence to let people know, particularly in some of the more out remote parts of the county. Some people just can't get into Olympia where there are a lot of services.
Right.
So we are...
For instance, we've been told to go to parking lots at the big box stores in the surrounding areas, because that's often where veterans will be camping out in their vehicles. And so we thought if we show up, we have good signage plus signboards on the thing that we can put out there, and we're working with other faith communities to announce that we're going to be in the area. We have one lady who is helping us work with the indigenous communities in three different nations, so that, and it's surrounding the area of Thurston County. So we have an impact that, you know, we can help make a difference in the lives of veterans, plus calling attention to the cost of war.
Right. Do you guys have a web page that folks can look at what you've got going up there at 109?
We do, and
I believe we do. There's two different, isn't Dennis?
Yeah, there's two different ones, and it's under construction right now because we needed to update some stuff, but it's
sure.
veteransforpeace109.org, and the old site, which we are still trying to restore, is vfp109rcc.org. But, you know, that one way that you can do to find, you know, information for us is just to send email to either Mark or myself, and we'll be glad to send you, you know, some of the links and videos that we're collecting, because Mark and I also produce a monthly television show called Veterans Hour on Thurston Community Media, and we've interviewed a number of people on veterans' homelessness as well as other issues, and we'll be glad to send them that information.
Great.
And my email is mills.dennis@gmail.com, and that way I can send you or anyone listening at KBOO information that they might want.
And I can also repost this on our Facebook page as well, your emails. Would that be okay with you?
Oh, certainly. We'd be glad to do that.
Dennis, is it Mill or Mills?
Mills, M-I-L-L-S.
Okay, Mills, gotcha. Yeah, whoop. Angie, I'm not any good at Facebook stuff, so Angie does all that for us. So, yeah, we'll put it on the Facebook page, and that'll you know, help a lot. How many people you think you guys have helped in this short time you've had this?
Overall, so we've been doing this now 6 years, and we went back and counted, and we have like 132 veterans that we've seen over the period of that time.
That's great.
So some come in just once and we never see them again. Some we've worked with over the years, and we've had some really good success. If we have a veteran coming in doing a new claim, we've been pretty successful with that. But we've also had any number of Vietnam veterans coming in 40 years after the fact.
Right.
And had success with those as well. So,
well, that's good. That's good. It's really important.
One of the things that we seek to do is to be both, well, really to educate them how they could do it themselves if they're capable of doing that, so that they can develop a fully developed claim.
Right.
And that's really our interest in doing that. And some have tried it on their own, or they've gone to other organizations. And we have often found that, you know, it was not completely filed, and the VA just held it up for, in many cases, years.
Right.
So we go in and say, well, here's what's needed to perfect this claim. They do it, and they get their benefits, or we show them how they can upgrade their benefits.
See, I was going to ask you about that.
They may have only 30% or more, and we can say, have things worsened since you received that rating?
Right.
And if it has, we can show them how to initiate the process to update that claim.
Yeah, how about updating less than honorable discharges?
Less than honorable? Matter of fact, Mark, you might tell them about, we work with GI Voice, which used to be called Coffee Strong, and tell them about the number of calls we get now.
And we, you know, we will also work with veterans on that. GI Voice was doing that specifically. These days, we are working with some veterans on those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a problem, you know, it's a difficult thing to do.
Yes.
But mainly, one of the things that Dennis and I have done with all the claims is to, you know, here's the process. Here's what you need to show. Here's why. And really, as like Dennis said, not only just what goes into it, but how to advocate for themselves, how to make their own case.
Right.
And that really goes a long way. But yeah, so we do both the claims and the discharge upgrades. Success with discharge upgrades, that's much more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mark and Dennis, can you say when your van will launch again? And can you also repeat the way of getting in contact with you?
Yeah. Surely. Well, it's getting real close now because we have all new tires and new signs on it. And so probably within a month or so, we're thinking of being able to do that. We're arranging with the Lazy Veterans Hub as to which places would they like us to go. So we're saying about within a month. And
great.
Probably the easiest way to get in contact is to use my personal mail at mills.dennis@gmail.com. Or if they wish, they can contact me by the old-fashioned snail mail, and I can give my home address if you'd like that.
We'll leave that alone. Who knows where that could go, unless it's a P.O. box.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
But I will repost this on the Facebook page, and we're going to leave it at that for now. But I really appreciate you coming on, and I hope to have you back on after you have been out serving some of the people that you are planning to help. Maybe we can have you back on again.
Very good. We do appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you for having us on
KBOO. Okay, have a good one.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Okay, and now we're going to speak with Dave. And Dave, I've known Dave for about 5 years, would you say?
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so it's good to have you on, and I think that one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on was because it seems like a lot of things are being overshadowed by this Trump administration stuff and everything that's going on, which there's nothing less important about that. But I think that some of the things that I know that you've experienced are just as important and play into what is going on now. So I'm hoping that we can just start with maybe you telling the listeners what your name is, what you did, why you joined the military, and where the story goes from there.
Okay, be glad to. So I hope I don't, you know, I spoke with Angie over the years in Portland public school system around military recruitment, providing equal access and full disclosure recruitment information to students in the Portland public school. So you know, I'm going to probably repeat plenty of times what you've heard, so I apologize for that.
That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, so let's see. I joined the military mostly because what motivated me at the time, you know, I couldn't tell you, was just
And what year was this?
This was in, I graduated from high school in 1982 in Arizona. And I joined January of 1983. So I had about 7 months between the time I exited high school till the time I entered service. Mm. And it was a peacetime military. I had two brothers who preceded me. An older brother who has retired after many years, a retired sergeant major. And then my second brother who retired after 7 or 8 years, and I think sergeant first class, both in the Army. We all entered and served in the same company, in the same battalion, in the same unit. We overlapped. So my Wow. oldest brother and my middle brother overlapped for I don't know how long. And then my oldest brother moved on to a different duty. And then my middle brother and I overlapped in our service. So we all served at Fort Lewis, Washington, the 2nd Ranger Battalion there. And my periods of service were, I guess, June of 83 to January of 86. And so I had mixed motives. You know, I was a kid. I didn't really know. It was kind of the thing that the momentum of my family and upbringing brought me, you know, towards the service, because my father was a World War II veteran, served in the Pacific Theater, and also was part of the occupation forces of Japan after Japan surrendered. And he and my mom both kind of their coming together as a couple was around the period of World War II. So as far as the family kind of ideology and the stuff that was said and that I grew up around was concerned with being of service and doing one's duty and kind of this orientation around that there was, you know, if it wasn't the Japanese, if it wasn't the Nazis, there certainly would be the next enemy of the U.S. And it was up to, you know, my family, my sister, you know, was not part of that conversation. She was the oldest, and she, you know, went through her own war as being a woman in our culture, you know, and especially within the division of labor in my family too. Like, she was kind of to the side, you know, between, you know, against the kind of the how the masculinity and the patriarchal kind of stuff was the dominant, you know, narration of my family. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I want to give props to her because she, you know, still like, she's a part of the story too. And my mom as well. And you know, I guess I'm saying that because I've talked about this, you know, and I kind of, that's just not, never really a part of the, what I share. And so there was that kind of ideology and lore around service. And also, my dad never spoke very directly about his military service, but it came out through his behavior.
Yes.
It came out through his, how he treated, you know, his loved ones in the intimate family setting. And it was not a happy home environment for me. It was, for me being the youngest, I was neglected. You know, it was within the proximity of my family, but as far as what I was up to and what I got away with was a lot. And that's also part of my story, because I started using drugs at a young age in high school. And very, you know, like at the moment that I started using marijuana, I used it all the time. And it's, you know, very much a part of who I am today as far as that relationship with using substances. So part of my motivation was to satisfy my dad as far mm-hmm. as, like, you know, I would show him I could do it. That I could also, there was a part of a motivation to serve my country, that I had this kind of, this sense that I owed or wanted to do some, you know, duty towards this, whatever I thought, you know, didn't really have a very clear sense of that. And then also for me, it was to kind of get away from the people I was hanging out with. And I thought it would clean me up, you know, I would, get away from those elements. And also, I would show other people that I wasn't just, mm-hmm. you know, a dirt bag or, right. You know, a do nothing or whatever that was, you know. So I had mixed motives. And also having two brothers who preceded me in this peacetime military. So they would share with me the details of what they did, and my middle brother especially, around the operational capacity of this unit. And it gave me an idea that I would be doing this stuff that was considered special operations, and that there was some that I would be called upon to perform, that I would be called upon to be skilled, and to, you know, that it wasn't, I was just not going to be thrown into some situation where I was just a bullet catcher. And, you know, that turned out to be something like that was the case. But as far as what prompted me to think it was a good idea, that was in there too.
Mm-hmm. Where did you end up going?
Well, so that's the thing. It's a peacetime military, but the Ranger Battalion's mission, which I believe is still the same mission, is to plan and conduct special military operations in support of U.S. policies and objectives. And so special means, in the case of my service, is that we did, you know, real-world combat deployments during peacetime. So, for instance, while I was in, the Grenada operation happened right when I got into the unit, and the battalion was deployed. They parachuted, did a 500-foot parachute assault on the island of Grenada under intense enemy anti-aircraft and small arms fire, the first type of combat parachute assault since World War II. And since I was new, they'd broken my unit up into the new and the senior enlisted, and the senior enlisted went on that deployment, of which was my brother. And then thereafter, we were training in Panama. I went to Panama Jungle Operations Training Center 3 times during my service. And from one of those in 1984, we did an emergency deployment to Honduras, where my company, we dug into a defensive perimeter, dug foxholes, had fields of fire, had our basic load of ammunition, had fatigues with no identifying markers on it. And so it was essentially a combat deployment within the context of a training deployment to Panama. And from the perimeter, we did reconnaissance patrols, and we also did squad-size ambush patrols from that perimeter. So all night, each squad would pull off the line and go out and set up an ambush. And whether or not people walked through that kill zone or that ambush, the ambush was set off mostly, what I recall, is like every hour throughout the night. So every hour at night, you'd hear the sound of claymores detonating, 90-millimeter recoilless rifles, M60 machine guns, and M16 small arms fire. So there was that. And during that deployment, my platoon leader was killed by our own 60-millimeter mortars in a fire mission that he received a direct hit from, and several other Rangers were severely injured, you know, shrapnel and sucking chest wounds and that. And there's a whole story around that, and I don't know how important it is to the context of Nicaragua right now, but, you know, there's a lot there. And so there was that. And then in 1985, I was in Egypt on another training mission around the Sinai Peace Agreement as a product of the Arab-Israeli War, called Operation Bright Star. And we just basically sat in tents in the desert. But from there, we did another similar deployment to Somalia in 1985, where it was another, it was connected to the 1993 Black Hawk Down stuff.
Mm-hmm.
However, this was another Cold War proxy war that the U.S. was fighting to help establish this country called Eritrea. And it was, you know, the Soviet Union was in alliance with Ethiopia, and the U.S. was in alliance with Somalia at the time. And just from my own experience in that whole 3 years, I just basically felt like I ran through the whole period. And I kind of said in the class that I spoke in Cleveland the other day with Penny, and that in the beginning, as being a young person and not knowing my capabilities and being afraid and all that, I had to try to keep up. And then by the end of my 3 years, it was like people had to keep up with me because I like had adjusted and mm-hmm. became hardened and brutal and calloused. And I, you know, a lot of ways I was prepared for in my family. You know, the way I was brought up kind of fit with the military. So that, I say that because that's what I exited with, was this, I don't know, I don't want to say it's an identity, but certainly, like, just to kind of take my thinking out of the process, that there was some really severe kind of conditioning that I experienced, not just through the kind of training, but the brutality and the community around that brutality that we were all oriented towards. It was all orientating ourselves towards killing people,
right?
And how to develop and be very skilled and professional in that, but still the bottom line was how to get rounds, you know, deliver rounds on a
and
target.
You were in for 3 years?
I was in for three years, right? Yeah. So I, through my enlistment, I attended basic training, airborne school, ranger indoctrination program, and then I attended a pre-ranger course, it's called, that prepared me to attend ranger school, which is a combat leadership school developed in 1952 to condition officers to the conditions of battle so that they can make decision-making and create operation orders and do this stuff under, you know, intense pressure. And the way that they did that in that school was to remove food and sleep as reliable supports. And so, you know, you basically devolve and lose weight, and mm-hmm. and then through that exhaustion, you have to perform these tasks. So mostly everybody in my unit in the Ranger Battalion went to that school. And so for my experience of being a leader, like these were people who were easily led, you know, like I didn't need to tell people what to do. And when I was new and learning, it was the same, you know, for me being a follower. So that affects me today and how I approach whenever I'm in a leadership position is I kind of have to be reminded of that my expectations about people have to be a lot less.
Right. So how did... You went to Nicaragua after Somalia?
Yeah, so here's the story. I didn't study in high school. I knew I was joining the military. I went through that whole experience, and like I said, I just kind of went through and didn't really register the effects of like seeing people get killed or mm-hmm. you know, having explosions around, being shot at or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got out, I had the college money that I thankfully had done this contract for the Veterans Educational Assistance Program. And I very quickly ended up at U of O, University of Oregon, at the encouragement of my aunt to just jump right into school. And if I hadn't, I would have, you know, who knows, I would have gone to some community college and taken one course. But yeah. I went in full time. My hair was still short. And I was motivated, disciplined. I had like these reserves of physical you know, stamina and whatever, like mm-hmm. I was in excess capacity to take on all this stuff. So I read everything and I was hungry to apply myself. And I gravitated towards sociology, and I had these teachers who took an interest in me, and they happened to be radical social, like a, one was a Marxist social theorist. I mean, that's a polite way of saying a Marxist.
Yeah.
And so I had a couple men in a kind of mentor role in school who helped me to kind of like directed me to what to read and what I was interested in. And I learned, you know, in the classroom and outside the classroom around the politics and history of the of Nicaragua. And I put in, could see the context of why I was in the place I was in December of 1984. It was during a period of elections. And I learned about the war of economic destabilization that this that my unit and also secret operations and also the Contra effort was a part of, this larger strategic effort to destabilize the country. And since the tools that I'd had developed, you know, up to that point in the military, I thought the best idea for me, or that the right thing to do, was then to go fight or support the country that, in my opinion, through learning about the history, was really more closely connected to my idea of what a democratic kind of revolutionary movement was, more relatable to me, you know, than the founding fathers and all that stuff. And so I was, you know, I read everything I could, and I remember reading this one book called Fire in the Mountain. It's by Omar Cabezas.
Yeah.
And he talks about, he was part of the insurrection, but preceding that, he was part of this the emerging guerrilla forces that developed in response to this dictatorship that had been in power for over 100 years. And reading that book about the suffering that he and his fellow guerrillas went through and experienced just to overthrow this dictatorship, and the monumental task that was at the at their placed at their feet to overthrow them. You know, it was never any idea that was the start until still they developed these kind of communities and message methods of communicating and political, you know, they it just evolved. And so when I read that, I could relate to the suffering, and I could relate to their wanting to overthrow this very brutal, very brutal, but you know, for them, commonplace, where the dictatorship was not interested in the people, that they were interested in extracting resources, which is, you know, a common phenomena. So all that, you know, I became politicized. I became radicalized, and I thought, well, what, you know, I fought for the wrong country. I was a tool, and I was fighting for the man, the oppressor, or whatever. So my idea of social justice was to just basically take up arms against the U.S. That was what really was inspired. I was inspired to do. Now, you know, what that looked like is I volunteered with 10 other U.S. mostly just out of college kids to participate in a building project in a town called Adalia. It's in the state of Matagalpa. It's a central northern Nicaragua, mountainous region, and the area of which a lot of fighting was happening during the Contra War. So before I say that, though, I do want to emphasize this idea of, like I said, I referred to the war as a war of economic destabilization. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the sanitized way of saying it was a war of terror.
Right.
So the United States and the former Somoza leadership and some soldiers, you know, wanted to take back this country from the Nicaraguan Revolution, the people who had overthrown them and been, you know, elected into power. And instead of a head-to-head conventional battling against fortified position, you know, type of warfare, the strategy was to create so much havoc and chaos that the demands of the people to be protected against the chaos and violence and brutality would tax the state so much that they collapse. And that's how the war was politically won, was through that, you know, through the terror. And the terror is like, you know, that these contra elements would come into towns and they would find the leaders or the teachers or business people or whatever, the people who were the community organizers or leaders, and they would kill them, or they would rape and mutilate women. They would, you know, kill babies and, you know, in front of people. And it was all to incite terror, which it did. And of course, then the people demanded to be protected by the Sandinista military. And
I think that a lot of people don't know, but the Contras were backed by the United States.
Yes.
That's what, you know, the stuff you're talking about is that some of our listeners probably don't know that or remember that the Contras were financed, supplied, everything by the U.S. government.
Absolutely.
There you go.
Yeah. They wouldn't have been much.
Nothing. Yeah. Were you there? Did you know Ben Linder?
I didn't know Ben Linder. He was killed in 87. I was there at the very end of 89. So,
okay.
So I knew of him.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to continue with what was going on at the school?
Sure, yeah. So this is all, you know, really kind of, for me, still present stuff for me.
Mm-hmm.
In that a lot of what transpired in Nicaragua post-service, you know, affected the rest of my kind of adult life as far as what I needed to do next. And so I was down there with these other North Americans. We were building the school in this very unstable area, which meant there was gunfire and explosions and violence and threats. And what the kind of details around that is that it was a time when the elections were happening in 1990, which resulted in the Sandinistas being kind of voted out of power. And as part of this kind of preparatory agreement to make this democratic election more democratic, the Sandinista government agreed to repatriate Contra forces into the country and repatriate by providing places to live and a kind of way of to kind of be not just occupy and show up, but to give them kind of some purchase in communities. And in the town that I was in, had 200 to 300 of these repatriated Contra soldiers. And you know, they weren't, some of them were not necessarily like outliers. They were, they'd lived there before, or they had these family. So there's all these dynamics happening, you know, and all I see is I'm living with a family that is a Sandinista family as far as, you know, the both Nelson and Melba were the mother and father of a small family, and they'd met during the insurrection. And so a lot of people refer to the Nicaraguan Revolution, and they're referring to where the overthrow of the government happened, and that's the revolution. But really what the Nicaraguan people refer to as that point is the insurrection, the triumph, right? That's where Sandinista, the Somozas fled the country, and that's like a great time of liberation and celebration for the people. Like all the effort and all the momentum preceded that was the culminating event. And then the revolution is what happened after. That was where the Sandinista government they weren't the government at the time. They did a kind of provisional elections or whatever, established this kind of infrastructure, and then did this literacy campaign to raise the level of literacy among the people so that they could hold these kind of elections where the people were participants instead of, you know, under gunpoint or whatever, you know, just kind of throwing something in a box that is the only box to put their vote in. So I say that. I don't know why I said that. I just went off. So I was down there during this unstable time living with the Sandinista family. And, yeah, Nelson and Melba, they'd met during the insurrection. That was their story. Nelson, the father, was convinced that when I was there that I was a CIA person working in a brigadista capacity, because there was a lot of these elements coming down to support the revolution from the U.S. cult. They were called brigadistas, so they're volunteers helping with coffee harvest, building stuff. Ben Linder was a kind of more skilled part of that. You know, he helped with hydroelectric projects in the upper Bokai, it's called, state of Bokai region. And so I was with these group of other North Americans, and we, in some ways, it was really, there was a lot of ignorance around what we were doing, because we raised the money to buy supplies to build the school, and we provided the labor. Really, what would have been beneficial is to ask the community what would have been helpful. We have these funds, and then maybe give them the funds so that they could employ and develop something that would engage their, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so there's that. But so it was a 4-month project. We didn't complete the school, you know, it wasn't fully completed. And so I'm with people who had not served in the military. They're out of college. And so I say this now because I've some friends I still talk to. I have one very dear friend who's in San Francisco who we've been in contact since this period. And I saw everything through the lens of my past. So I saw war and conflict and violence. And as far as the other people, they saw other things. They saw what they saw. And so up to this point, with regard to my service and my military awareness of how the manifestations of my service were, you know, coming to the surface, I had no container to understand how I was affected.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just thought I was sick. I thought I was crazy. Also, in Nicaragua, that was the first time when I drank alcohol. I drank alcohol so I could pass out,
right?
Like alcohol, like I just wanted to quit, you know, shut everything off.
You think a lot of that was a survivor's guilt?
And I haven't touched on that, because that, you know, if there's any kind of something that I can say as like the most profound way I've been affected is through a very close connection with other soldiers who are dead.
Right.
So I had very close, a couple or three close friends who were killed, some in combat, some in training, and some of them were killed by, you know, using alcohol and driving, or getting hit by, like a friend of mine got hit by a train while he was tripping on acid, and another friend was shot accidentally by another ranger, and they were drinking and they hadn't checked the weapon, and he got shot in the chest and just died like that. So a lot of like crazy, you know, really coarse kind of bravado, high
macho
risk
stuff.
So,
like, you know, the family that you were with in Nicaragua, they knew that you were ex-military, right?
Yeah,
you think
that's the thing.
That affected it?
I do.
He thought you were something.
Yeah, like, I was saying to everybody, I was like, look, I was, you know, Estaba en la Frontera in 1984. You know, I was telling people I was there in the U.S. And so, like, I wanted to kind of purge myself and say, I was part of this. I, you know, and I'm here to help you. Like, look at me, you know. And what Nelson was sensitive to is that the CIA, through the way that they did it, they would get people to kind of go along in these brigadistas. They would, they weren't necessarily operatives, but they're people who maybe had a criminal record or were in trouble, and they were encouraged to go and kind of create problems.
Right.
And so Nelson was, you know, he saw this apparently, and he just was convinced that that's where I was coming from. And it wasn't until we actually sat down
and
drank,
talked it out.
Well, we drank it and talked.
Right.
That, you know, there was a turn for him where he was like, okay, you're all right.
He believed you after that. So when you were in the military and in Nicaragua, your job at that time was training Contra?
Yeah, so I was in the Mosquito region.
Yeah, Mosquito, yeah.
In Honduras on the Rio Coco, very close to the Rio Coco. And we did our operation, our style of operating, which is basically infantry ambush raid, right? And my squad had two Contra soldiers attached to my squad. They just came along. They were quiet. Mm-hmm. There was no communication. And there were other kind of, I don't know who they were, but there were people with long hair in our perimeter, like wearing fatigues, like either.
Right.
Who knows?
Let's get back to what was going on at the school at that time. I want to finish that story so we can continue with that.
Stop. Yeah.
Yeah, we get stuck with military stuff.
Yeah. So, like I said, I saw the violence and I was hypersensitive to the tension and the house I was living in, the room I was staying in had an exposed area because it was a A-frame roof on a brick square leveled mm-hmm. walls with this triangular opening. And one of the times around I arrived there, Nelson said that he wanted to make sure that was sealed off from my room because of grenades.
Wow.
And then around that time, he had gotten this altercation with somebody who showed up at his house and came to the door, and they had pistols, but they're holstered, and they're arguing. And the house had a weapon in every room that I stayed in. They ended up, after, you know, gaining some trust, they gave me an AK to sleep with in my room, and it was like, I was happy of that. And across the street was a community center. Just a building, and it had these. It had been some people had thrown some these grenades at some type of attack, and there were all these scars from the detonated grenades against the building. So, for me, I just was like adding all this up as like, okay, so I can't really sleep here. You know, this is where I'm staying, and so I was awake a lot of the time, and that weapon that I got to sleep with. So all this stuff made sense to me because it was like I was embattled. I was in this fortified house with these people who I was like going to fight with or whatever. And it made sense to me. I was comfortable with that. And so a couple things happened while I was there, one of which was just in a nutshell where we were getting fired up by one or two people with AKs at night, and we is the group of us people who are building the school. And during that point of receiving that fire, like I knew where it was coming from. I knew it was AK. I knew that it was coming at us. And I remember in the classroom, I made myself sit up in my chair, and I remember pulling my shoulders back so that I wanted to get shot. And for me, in retrospect, looking back, it's like I kind of wanted to die there as some that would conclude my life, like because mm-hmm. I had these friends who didn't survive,
right?
And I didn't know how to live outside of the military because I didn't have I had this young mind that was somehow convinced that the only way for me to have my, is to give in service or to die like my brothers died. You know, that was really not at the tip of my tongue at the time, but I just did that, right? And thankfully, nothing happened. There were these militia guys who came down and they turned the lights out in the school and told us we needed to scramble and get out of there. And at the moment we exited the school, I got on the ground. I started crawling and I did all these things that I didn't think about doing, but really I was getting down to the ground so that I could see any silhouettes ahead of me against the whatever limited visibility against the sky. Mm-hmm. I was using whatever available light to see if someone was approaching, and then I got ahead of the group and I started crawling, and then I stood up and I got in front of the group to go back to the town. Because this school was maybe a kilometer out of the town, down a slope in the bush, and then upon going up the hill towards the light of the town, these people who were shooting at us started shooting at us in a ambush orientation, so I'm the lead of the group of people behind me, and so for me that's like we're a squad. mm-hmm. and I'm the lead element of the squad. And so when they started firing, what I remember about that is that I turned towards the gunfire and I started going, my body was moving down towards the gunfire. And in my mind, I was thinking, I'm gonna
get them.
Yeah, I everything was around, you know, what, I don't know what, killing them. I was offended, you know. It wasn't like, oh, this is not a good idea, or I want to be safe. It was like, I just, like, all that, you know, that instinct for self-preservation was not there.
Right.
And for me, that was an important moment because I, like, my mind or my awareness was seeing what I was doing and saying this isn't the best idea, right? So there was part of me, the part of me post-service, or the part of me that was motivated to join and be of service to people, to be a peaceful person, to be a caring person, was in conflict with the kind of orientation of my machinery to kill people, like it just built, you know, mm-hmm. built on that, and then this being offended, and then this kind of pushing away some idea that my life was worth, you know, survive, you know, staying safe, you know. So that was a critical moment for me in kind of what became next in my life, was to kind of unpack and address who I was and why or not so much why, but to understand how deeply affected I was by my being a ranger and a ranger battalion and the training and all of that, like having the experience that all of that stuff really did manifest in a reality that was not really healthy.
Right. We only have a couple minutes left, but can you tell people what it was like in the few years afterwards, and how do you cope with things now?
2 minutes.
Yeah.
So
1 minute each.
Luckily, you know, up to that point, I'd worked in a vet center. It's a readjustment counseling center. There's one in Portland, 122nd and Halsey. Mm-hmm. It's a counseling center for combat deployed veterans. It's connected to the VA, and it's got a mission and a kind of permission to operate, kind of not necessarily under the extreme guidelines and paperwork and all that stuff that the VA has to. And I received care there only because I worked as a work study before I went to, you know, right when I got out and wasn't going to school. And so when I got back to the U.S. after being in Nicaragua post-service, I knew I needed help. I was like, okay, so this is a place where I can go. And I went to a vet center in Portland, Maine, where I landed, and my partner, girlfriend at the time, was living there. And so I went into that vet center and I said, can I talk to somebody? And they turned me away because I wasn't a Vietnam veteran.
No.
And so this is 1990. Mm-hmm. And so I kept going, and I got a job filing papers and whatever. And then a few months after my return ticket was Seattle, Washington, and that was my end destination from that time in Nicaragua. And when I landed there and stayed with a friend, and I went to the vet center there, and I didn't ask for help. I told them they needed to help me, and so I was lucky that there were people there who could see that I had problems and that it wasn't necessarily connected to Vietnam. And they opened their doors and they provided great care and comfort and counseling and got me plugged in. And then I entered the VA machine, and then I did their whole, what they had to offer for 7 or 8 years, some of which was really great around group therapy, but a lot of medication.
Yeah.
I did a couple hospitalizations where the sole purpose of the hospitalization was to run all kinds of meds through me to just see which one would work. So in the end now, right now, I have made a conscious effort to stay away from any type of mood or mind altering substance. It's so important for me. I want to be of service in a way that motivated me to join the military, but I'm not going to do that at the agenda or behest of any group organization because they're just faulty.
Great.
There's just too much there.
And you also go to group meditations, don't you?
Yeah, I have the privilege and honor of being a student of a Buddhist monk who is also a Vietnam veteran.
What's his name?
His name is Claude Anchin Thomas.
I know him.
Yeah. He's been around, and hopefully he'll be here back in Portland next year. And he's helped me immensely with just working with my service and how we live with the consequences of that. So yeah, every Wednesday at 8 p.m. at the Daya Yoga Studio on Bancroft and near Hamilton and Bancroft, Lair Hill area, I do a veterans meditation group.
Great. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the invitation.
We'll be back Friday, May 19th at 9 a.m., and there it is.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn.
And that winds up Veterans Voice, heard here on KBOO at 9 to 10 every third Friday of the month. Thanks for tuning in today, and we're going to move on to Eric Cascadia coming up right next.
Now look at all we want with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Lonesome City EP release, Saturday, April 29th, at the Alberta Street Pub in Portland. The event celebrates the debut solo EP release from Avery Levine. Avery Levine is a Portland-based singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist specializing